Welcome to the podcast. I am Joe Posnanski, and with me is Michael Shore. Michael, welcome.
Joe, thanks for having me.
Mike, you sound a little down there. You sound.
I can't help it, man. It's like, get to November, and you're looking at 3 months before pitchers and catchers report, 3.5 months, really. And then that isn't even that exciting because then it's another month and a half before the games start. And then the games start, and you have that dumb thing where your team plays one game, and then they're off the next day. And I can't. I mean, it's so long. It's so long before baseball is back.
It's so depressing. It is so, so depressing. And there's nothing. I don't know how we survive these months without baseball. And by the way, I mean, I used to be able to survive by watching the NFL. The NFL would take me into February, right? It would
sure
February. And now, well, first of all, I mean, we don't need to go into great detail on this, but I believe that you are the backup quarterback for the Jacksonville Jaguars at this point. Is that not correct? I think
that is true. Yeah. Well, I'm actually the backup for four different teams. I have four different contracts. I'm the backup for the Texans.
Sure.
I'm the third stringer for the Jaguars.
Right.
I'm now also I'm starting for the Packers this week.
Oh, that's weird. That's crazy.
Yeah, as soon as we're done here, I got to fly to, I don't even know where they are. They sent me a ticket. I got to fly out there. And then I am the second string and third string and practice squad QB for the Patriots,
wow,
which is kind of fun because they're my favorite team.
They're your favorite team? That's awesome. That's awesome.
So so if something happens to Brady, I go in. And then if something happens to me, I replace myself.
Which weird, but so you decided not to go to the Bears, is what you're saying? Because I know.
Yeah,
Bears,
well, I mean, they have a pending offer,
right,
that, for me to be the backup there as well. But I feel like four teams is sort of the
four
max
teams,
for me.
Yeah, you can't spread yourself too thin on any given Sunday. It is the NFL is as depressing. You know, the NFL is depressing anyway. I mean, the NFL has so many depressing elements to it. And then I'm on a cross-country flight yesterday from LA back home after the baseball season ended. And for some reason, this is not a complaint, but there was no Wi-Fi on the plane. I've not been on a plane flight that long, domestically, that didn't have Wi-Fi. There was some problem, I guess. So that's 5 hours. I was able to sort of stay clear of all the news and everything else. It was kind of freeing. And I landed, and the first thing I saw when I landed, and I turned on my phone, and there was a text from a friend saying, "I can't believe it." That's all it said. I can't believe, and I can't believe it could be whatever. I mean, and I don't even know what he was specifically. He might have been referring to Trump's Twitter account being, destroyed for a
safe bet. Yeah.
But I think he was referring to the fact that only the most exciting young player in the NFL and one of the most exciting young players in a long time got hurt it wasn't even a contact thing. It wasn't even a contact injury.
Not only was it a non-contact injury, it was at a practice.
Yeah.
He wasn't even in a game. He wasn't even like trying to score. I mean, I tweeted about this the other day. It is so, I don't know if it's always been this absurd. Maybe it has always been this absurd. I don't know. And I just turned a blind eye to like the thoroughness of the disappointment. But Aaron Rodgers and J.J. Watt and Deshaun Watson and Odell Beckham Jr.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like they've made a list
of the
biggest stars in the sport,
right,
and they are not being knocked off one by one, and they're out for the season. And it's shocking. I mean, forget about Zeke Elliott either being suspended or not suspended every hour. There's an update every hour about whether he is out or in. But I mean, of the 10 biggest stars in the sport, like six of them are out for the year.
And
you know, it's just like, I don't know how you stay interested, frankly, in the sport when you know, the Texans are kind of like, ooh, that's an up-and-coming team. No, it's Tom Savage. Tom Savage is your quarterback now. And it's like, wow, Aaron Rodgers is leading the Packers. Nope, sorry, it's Matt McGloin or whoever it is. You know, I just don't know how you – I mean, Ryan Tannehill's been out for the year since before the year started. The Dolphins are terrible. And Julian Edelman is out for the year before the year starts. And then the year starts and all these other guys just one by one. I mean, it's almost like teams should start their practice squad at the beginning of the year. I really think that – I think there's an argument to be made where you start your second stringers at the beginning of the year, and then when they get hurt, you insert your starters. Because it's just like at the beginning of the year, you know, everything is sort of up in the air and there's weird upsets and teams aren't used to playing and there's this kind of anything can happen. I think for the first four games of the year, you should start your backups. And then because it's just too, the sport's too brutal. You can't, by the time you get to the end of the year, know everyone who's playing is a person you've never heard of before.
Yeah, well, it's like you should just extend the preseason because, you know, that's all that is as well. You know, it's just a bunch of boring, irrelevant games with players. We don't even mention Andrew Luck is going to miss the entire year. I mean,
yeah,
it's like
right. You know, oh, the other two, he is. It's an afterthought. Andrew Luck is like, well, yeah, Andrew Luck exists, but he's not. I mean, he hasn't come close to the
field.
Every time he throws, he forget about throwing a football. He got out of his car a week ago and tossed his keys to the valet and strained his shoulder, and he was out for six more weeks.
It's awful. It's awful. The Deshaun Watson thing hit me harder than almost any of them, just because we're just getting to see this guy. I mean, look, I'm not even following the NFL this year, and I'm excited about him. I mean, he's fun to watch. I just see highlights of him, and I'm just blown away. And obviously, the fact that the Browns should have drafted him and didn't has some bearing there as well. And you know, and for him to just get hurt, like, it's amazing to me, by the way, that yeah, of the six biggest stars in the NFL, of, you know, as far as Q rating, who's the guy that's going to be in the commercials or on the Tonight Show, whatever, the only one that's healthy, the only one, is 8,000 years old. That seems bizarre to me that the only guy that can stay healthy among that star group is Tom Brady. How is that possible? How is that possible?
I don't know. I mean, if you believe him, it's because he's magically learned how to, like, be tackled in the right way to avoid, you know, or because he puts some kind of ceramic bowl on his head when he sleeps that has a frequency that taps into the earth waves, the lunar waves coming from the moon. I mean, who knows? I mean, I probably, it's because he's really good at moving within the pocket,
right,
and getting rid
right.
of the ball
that's
before
right.
he gets hit. And he's been hit a lot this year. He's actually already been sacked more this year than he was all of last year, I read. And, you know, it, by the way, it's a matter of time, right? I mean, that's the harsh reality, is there's, if you were a betting man and someone offered you even odds on him starting every the next eight games, you would say no.
Right.
You would say absolutely not. There's no chance he does, because not because of him, because no one does.
Right.
No one survives. Like, no running back, wide receiver, quarterback, or lineman, or defensive lineman, or anybody. None of them survive the whole year.
Yeah,
I mean, like, you know, Gronk misses a couple games every year. And last year, the Patriots won the Super Bowl last year. I don't know if you remember that, but the New England Patriots won the Super Bowl.
Is that true?
Yeah, it is. I believe they won the Super Bowl in part because Tom Brady missed the first four games of the year. I really do. I think he only had to play 12 games, and that's a quarter of the season was removed from the injury risk was removed for a quarter of the season. And I feel like that's a big deal.
I think that this is clear what should be done here. As NFL commissioner and podcast commissioner, Roger Goodell should suspend every good player in the NFL for the first four games.
Yeah.
Just suspend
them. Or rotate them, right? Have a quarter of the league sits out the first four, and then the next quarter of the league sits out the next four.
Everybody plays 12 games, right? Everybody plays 12 games, and you cannot play the other four because you're suspended. I think that actually, that probably is like the safest way. They wanted to expand this season to 18 games.
It's so dumb.
Oh my gosh.
I also, by the way, I feel like if you're trying to moneyball football, right, you would, the number one sort of like threat to any franchise is injury.
Right.
By far the number one threat. It's not poor play or interceptions or fumbles or bad field position. It's obviously it's injuries. And so if you're trying to moneyball football, there's got to be people who are like, you know what? If we reduce the number of snaps that each player takes by 18% and rotate in guys at different positions, we will reduce our injury risk by this much, and then we have that much better of a chance of getting to the postseason. I think that the number one thing that the league, frankly, should be, that the players' union should be arguing for, is expanded rosters. They should be arguing that they're from 53 to 65. Pay 12 more guys, league minimum, and have, you know, create that many more jobs, 12 times 32 more jobs, and have that, even if it's league minimum salary, and have that many more guys be rotated in to save injury risk to the starters.
Like,
I think that's
it's pitch yeah. count. It's like the pitch count, right? I mean, you
figure, that's
right. You know, and I especially for skill position players who are really in the biggest. Not to say that offensive and defensive linemen aren't killing themselves. They are. I mean, look, Joe Thomas. You want to talk about another big star that's out for the year. But skill position players, if you're any kind of team with some success, I think about a couple of years ago when that Cincinnati Bengals team was really, really, really good. The year Hugh Jackson was their offensive coordinator, and they were really, really good. I think if Andy Dalton doesn't get hurt, they go to the Super Bowl. I really do. I think that team was that good. And he got hurt, and they didn't go to the Super Bowl, and they weren't going to the Super Bowl without Andy Dalton. I don't know. I mean, maybe you don't start him the last four games of the year or something. I mean, you're right. I mean, I think that these guys have to start thinking along the lines of we got to protect our players somehow.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Crazy.
Yeah. But we didn't come here to talk about injuries in football. We came here to talk about the completely disappointing anticlimactic Game 7 of the World Series.
But before we do that, let's very quickly do our Browns update.
Let's check in on the Cleveland Browns. How are they doing?
The Browns lost since the last time we talked. I know that's weird. They got kind of blown out by Minnesota in England in a very sad display of American football for our friends across the ocean, and then this is you'll like this. This is good. This might bring you back on board. You know, the NFL trade deadline came, and the Browns, I don't know if you know this, they don't really have a quarterback that they right. that they like. So the New England Patriots backup quarterback is a guy you might have heard of, a guy named Jimmy Garoppolo. The Browns coach, Hugh Jackson, has made it very clear for several months that he loves Jimmy Garoppolo and would love right. to have him for the team. And there was talk between the Browns and the Patriots for a trade during the offseason. Nothing came of it. Well, as the trade deadline approached, there was a real opportunity to get Jimmy Garoppolo. And the Browns front office didn't stay for the afternoon. They left. They went home.
Now, it should be noted, let me just jump in here and add a detail. Jimmy Garoppolo eventually was traded for a single second-round pick.
That's right.
Now, the Browns have a lot of draft choices coming up, including a second-round pick that they picked up when they just took on Brock Osweiler's
right.
salary. They just got a second-round pick.
That's right.
So then they got rid of Brock Osweiler. So they could have just taken that, apparently. They could have taken that second round pick and maybe added like a seventh or sixth or something.
Right.
And they could have had Jimmy Garoppolo based on what he eventually was traded for. There's the reason that you take on Brock Osweiler, that you pay him his guaranteed salary, because you end up getting the guy you really want, who's young and has a high ceiling. But they didn't do that. They went home for the day.
The 49ers jumped in and made the trade, right. Which upset Hugh Jackson and the coaching staff quite a bit, because they did not go home. They actually stayed and worked, as football people do during the season. And so apparently, in order to satisfy him the next day, they decided to go out and trade for a different quarterback that Hugh Jackson likes, a backup in Cincinnati named A.J. McCarron. And they finalized a deal where they would trade a second and a third, which definitely, by the way, would have gotten Jimmy Garoppolo, a second and a third round pick to Cincinnati for A.J. McCarron. Celebration, 5 minutes left before the trade deadline. they didn't send it into the NFL office and the trade fell through. So my question to you is this. Are you back on board, Browns fan? Can you back on board now?
No, I'm not. However, I'll tell you what would get me back on board, and I mean this sincerely. The totally plausible conspiracy theory that what actually happened was the front office, someone in the front office or the owner, Jimmy Haslam, made that deal, a second round pick and a third round pick for a completely untested quarterback, A.J. McCarron, who was pretty good at Alabama, but like hasn't done anything in the pros, hasn't really had a chance to, given, but like is a completely untested entity.
Yes.
And word of that trade got to someone smart in the front office, and they were like, we're not doing this. And they're like, you have to. We agreed to it. And they were like, no, we're not. You know why? You know how we get out of it? We, quote, forget, end quote, to fax the paperwork to the league office. And the trade deadline passes in 5 minutes, and then the trade falls through. Watch this. And someone said, we'll look like we're so incompetent. And they said, I don't care. Everybody already thinks we're incompetent. At least this time we'll be incompetent in the service of something good, which is not doing this insane trade, which is a second round pick and a third round pick for a backup quarterback who has barely played a snap in the NFL. And if you told me that that is actually what happened, which some people believe, I don't think I'd be back on board, but I would be more inclined to come back on board because it would tell me that the front office of the Browns is actually like on the ball.
Well, not really, but
that they did something. They avoided a Browns catastrophe by mimicking a Browns catastrophe. They actually avoided a Browns catastrophe.
I would say, by the way, because I've read some of that and I've thought, I'd say there's a 70% chance that's true. I really do believe that's true. I believe that it was not an act of complete stupidity to forget to send it in. I do believe that somebody in the front office didn't want to make that deal, and then this was the only way they could get away with it.
Yeah.
That's a fireable offense in my view. I mean, if you're the owner of this team and somebody did that to you, you would can that person, right? I mean, that seems fireable to me. And by the way, yeah, the trade itself would have been a disaster. I mean, there was nothing good happened in any stretch of this. But if you looked and said, I'm killing this deal in the way to make us look the stupidest possible way. Yeah, I'd fire that guy. I would definitely fire. I'd start firing everybody.
It should also be noted, though, that a second and a third.
Oh, it's insane.
It's insane.
That would have gotten Jimmy Garoppolo, though.
Easily. I mean, would have gotten, I mean, a second and a seventh got Wes Welker years ago, right? Like
yeah,
a fourth got Randy Moss or whatever it was. Like that you can get really good players for pretty medium draft picks in this league. Like, I mean, what did Kelvin Benjamin just go if he went
for nothing?
AJ McCarron, are you kidding me? If you told me AJ McCarron got traded, I would have guessed a fifth, maybe. Maybe a fifth and a seventh, or like a fifth and some practice squad player or something. Like, I mean, a second and a third.
Well, I really kind of, you know, knowing a lot about both of those teams, because I worked in Cincinnati for years and know Mike Brown, the owner, and all of that, I think I know how it went down. I mean, the Brown, you know, Mike Brown has very, very strong feelings of dislike for the Browns, because Mike Brown is the son of Paul Brown, who got fired by the Browns. So there's a lot of anger and all of that. I think there was panic after the Garoppolo thing was such a disaster. I think they had to get a quarterback. Hugh has made it very clear he does like A.J. McCarron. So I think they went to the Bengals and they said, okay, we'll give you like a fourth for McCarron. And they were like, no way. And he said, well, we'll give you a second round pick for A.J. McCarron. And they're like, yeah, no way. Give us a third also. And I think they were so panicked that they made the deal. And I do think somebody went, oh, no, we're not doing that. Well, how are you going to get out of it? We're going to do this. We're just going to completely, go underneath everything, undercut everybody, make us, our owner and our whole organization look like fools, but we're going to get out of this deal. Yeah, I think that's the Browns. I think that pretty much sums up the Browns right there.
So. Great. Well, then I'm not on board.
Let's go to game seven. Game seven of the World Series. You know, we did an emergency podcast leading into game seven of the World Series, which we got some things right, some things wrong. But the thing that we really got wrong was what a bummer of a game. What a just a bummer, right? It was a we were both there, and this was going to be the climactic moment of really one of the great World Series in recent memory, and now not one of the great World Series in recent memory because Game Seven was just a bummer.
Okay, so this is the only way that you can sort of look on the bright side, I think, is that what made games one through six so wonderful in part is the specific aspect of baseball that it's so hard to predict, right? That a game that you can have the same two teams play a series of games and you can get 3-1 and you can get 13-12 in the same series. You can have guys who are unhittable one game who get just absolutely obliterated the next game. You can have Cody Bellinger striking out on every single at bat, and then suddenly he goes 3-for-5 with a homer and two doubles or whatever. That's part of, obviously, this is a very, very old observation. It's part of what makes the game so wonderful. The only way I can look on the bright side is to say, okay, that same unpredictability of baseball means that sometimes after six scintillating, tense, interesting, complex, wild games with comebacks and home runs and unlikely heroes and all that sort of stuff, you can unpredictably get a total dud of a game seven where one team jumps out to an early lead. The other team never gets close. The thing just kind of winds down slowly. There are so few after six games where there were an unprecedented number of, oh my God, I can't believe that just happened moments. There were exactly zero of those moments in game seven. Zero. Like zero. Even the scoring was like Springer hit a home run. Yeah, he's hit a million of them. Like who cares? There was an error on a grounder that scored a guy from third. There was a Andre Ethier dribbled a single into right to score one run. There was not a single interesting thing that individual event that occurred. There were a couple storylines that emerged. One of them was Kershaw throwing four shutout innings. Another one was Charlie Morton doing essentially exactly what McCullers had done in game seven of the Yankee series, coming in and just slowly suffocating the other team. You know, he didn't allow a base runner, I think, for three innings.
It was really great.
Yeah. And so it's not like no one was good. It's just that there were, the entire series had been, I can't believe what just happened, moment after moment after moment. And then in game seven, we were so teed up for more of that and got none of it. There literally wasn't a single interesting moment in the entire game. At least you would say after the second inning, after Springer's home run, that was the last time something interesting happened, really.
Yeah. And even that was, you know, I mean, it was great, and George Springer was incredible this whole series. But even that, it was 3-0 at the time.
Right.
And it just, all that home run really did was say, okay, you're not going to see an interesting game today. That's all that home run really did. You know, it's interesting about when you look at this series, because all you have to do is make game seven into game five. Okay. So that's the fifth game played, and make game five into game seven. And this is one of the greatest World
Series
ever
played. Maybe of all time, yeah.
Right? Right. All you have to do is switch those two games. That's it. That's all you have to do. Same result. The Astros still win. It nothing to do with who wins the series or doesn't win the series. It just has to do with the tension and the drama and the excitement of the game. And, you know, there was so much anticipation for this game. And nothing
switch,
happened.
By the way, switch seven nothing and two, happened. And you have the same thing, right?
Oh, same thing. Absolutely. Same thing. You know, I mean, look, four wins for the Astros, three wins for the Dodgers. Two of the games, I would say, were lost by the team that should have won it, right? I think games two and game five, the Dodgers had big leads with the opportunity to finish it off and were unable to do it. Other than that, the games were, other than game seven, which I didn't think was all that well played either. I mean, it wasn't a bad game. It wasn't sloppy or whatever, but, you know, kind of the at-bats, nobody seemed to be really into the at-bats. A couple of guys looked hurt and beat up, and, you know, there was no real... I mean, the Astros used a million pitchers and then used one, you know, down the stretch, and it didn't feel there was no flow to the game. It didn't feel like there was this flow, and that's what had been there every other game. Even you know, I mean, game one, game six, these weren't classics, but they were taught, well played games with drama and tension. And you're right, after the 5-0 lead, there was. We texted each other during that time, do the Dodgers get the tying run on base at any point during this game? And they didn't. And they didn't really come close to getting the tying run on base at any point. It just, the game just kind of
just fizzled. And it fizzled early. And you could feel it fizzling early because in the first inning, so they give up 2 runs, right? Springer doubles. He moves to third and scores on this error, and then there's another run. It's 2-0, but there's only been one hit, right? So it's like, okay, first inning jitters. Taylor leads off the bottom of that inning with a double into the gap. And then Turner gets hit, right? Like he after an out.
Right.
And so you're like, all you need here, all you need is a single. And that, and you need a single
by
one of your best hitters. You need like Seager or Bellinger or Puig or somebody to just... hit a line drive single into the outfield, and this is a game. And the crowd was obviously, I mean, it seems silly to say this, but it was the loudest I've ever heard Dodger Stadium. The lead up to that inning, the first inning, like the right before that game started, it was so exciting.
It was insane.
You just needed one thing to go the Dodgers' way. And they got a little situationally unlucky in the second inning with the line drive that turned into the double play after another first and second nobody out. They loaded the bases with 2 outs. They had these moments where it was just, you just needed that one little thing to happen and the crowd would have been super into the game, and they just never got it. And they, even when they, you know, Puig had that little sort of flare line drive to first and later in the game with runners on, and it was like the little bloop over the second baseman's head that scores a run. The line drive that goes to where a guy would have been playing if he hadn't shifted. Like one of those situationally lucky moments, that good baseball karma that happens all the time. Like it's so common and it had happened constantly throughout the whole series. They just couldn't get lucky. They just never got lucky. And then you add to that the legitimately, like, what you would say have to say, like, the failure, the absolute abject failure of some of their hitters to come through. You know, Bellinger, despite the fact that he had that homer and a couple doubles and that triple that Springer misplayed, he struck out just time after time after time after time after time in the series, the whole series, and it was hidden by some of the wins. It was hidden by some of the pitching performances. But then you got to that game. You got to that game seven, and he came up a couple times early on with runners on base when they just needed that one big hit, He just looked lost. And it was he picked a really bad time to totally forget how to hit, which is the World Series.
Well, it's true. It's true. And honestly, it leads to a question, which is sort of a bigger question, which is obviously – this season was marked by the incredible performances of two rookies, right? Of Aaron Judge and Cody Bellinger. And both of those guys had postseasons where you saw them really exposed. I mean, obviously Judge had a couple of moments and so did Bellinger. And Bellinger actually had a pretty good championship series as well. But they're both really exposed. I mean, they now have one, they're 1-2 in strikeouts for a postseason. Bellinger is number one all time, and which is amazing for Aaron Judge.
He even seven gets fewer games,
series, right? I mean, he did it 7 fewer games, but they're 1-2, and you know, and look, that's what good pitching does. That's what great curveballs do. I texted you before when Bellinger was up the second time, I think, came up with runners on first and second. I texted you, he has no chance here. He has no chance. He was facing McCullers' curveball. They left McCullers in the game to face him because, you know, McCullers came out right after he faced Bellinger because they knew this guy can't hit McCullers' curveball, can't hit it. And he didn't come close. Didn't even come close swinging the bat. So question is, I mean, these guys are going to have to make adjustments. I mean, are they going to have sort of come back to earth years next year? Or, or are they going to make the adjustments where they're going to be, you know, able to hit? Because they're both going to see a whole lot of curveballs in 2018.
Yeah, the book is out. They're obviously both super athletes. And,
sure.
You know, but they each have a problem, right? The problem is for Judge is his size makes him, I think it makes it harder for him to adjust to the new way that they pitch to him. And you saw that, like, right. they went through that stretch where they completely solved him in the second half of the year, and he was absolutely flailing. And then there was a second, and then he adjusted, and then they made a second adjustment, and he started flailing again. And I think you may get, I don't know if Aaron Judge is going to have another year where he hits 50-plus home runs. You just don't know. I mean, you know, look, you don't know. And that doesn't mean he can't be valuable if he hits 38 or something, but you just, I don't know. He's not a spring chicken either, by the way, Aaron Judge. He's 25. Like, he's, you know, and obviously he's still very, very young, but like there's a reason it took him to 25 to get to the majors. And Bellinger is just, you know, I watched him all year going to games. Sorry, I go into games with my son, and he has the longest swing. His swing,
it's so long.
The bat starts at the backstop, and he's going to be the first hitter ever to reach base on pitcher interference, because his swing is at some point is going to hit the pitcher's glove on the follow through, and you watch it all year and you thought, well, that's the opposite of how you're supposed to hit, right? Like, you're supposed to be short and quick to the ball, and he is the opposite of that. But hey, look, you can't argue with success, right? Then you watch an entire pitching staff attack him with the same pitch, a slider or a curveball down and in, time after time after time. They did it to Seager too, by the way. Bellinger wasn't the only guy. I mean, I texted you a screen grab of Verlander pitching to Seager in game six, and it was like nine straight breaking balls that started on, you know, at the knees on the inside corner and ended in the dirt by their back foot, and they swung at all of them. They couldn't stop swinging at that pitch, and it was the same pitch every time. And so, you know, again, it's like they're not stupid. They're way smarter about hitting than we are, certainly. It's not like they don't know they have to make these adjustments, but my goodness. I mean, if it were easy to make an adjustment, they would have done it in game two, because they were attacked the exact same way in every single at bat, and the Astros were successful in almost every single at bat.
Yeah, well, I mean, I thought with Bellinger specifically, the real problem was he was trying. He really was trying to make some adjustments. I mean, his two strike swing was different. He did shorten it up, but it looked worse when he made the adjustment. It looked worse. It was one of those swings that made me tweet out that I said he looks like Roy Hobbs when he was dating Kim Basinger. And that's really what it was like. It looked to me like a guy who was sort of not just struggling with at the plate, but like in some sort of cosmic slump, you know, where it was like, oh my gosh, what would happen if he did hit the ball swinging like that? It wouldn't have gone anywhere. It was, you had no idea what he was doing. And you know, I think that, look, he's 22 years old. I'm not down on him. I'm not down on Judge. I think both those guys are going to make some adjustments. But you do wonder if it will ever be like this. Like this year, one thing you cannot do with Cody Bellinger or Aaron Judge is throw them a fastball. Can't throw them a fastball.
Right.
Can't throw it by him. Cannot throw it by him. So are people going to still try to challenge him with a fastball? Not everybody has a good curveball. Not everybody else has a good slider. So they'll still face some pitchers who are going to have to try to challenge them, and they're still going to have success, but are they going to be able to make the adjustment to hit those curveballs and sliders and breaking stuff that really, and it's the same pitch. It's just, it's a righty and a lefty, but it's the same pitch. For Bellinger, it's down and in. For Judge, it's down and out. It's the pitch that breaks a foot out of the strike zone. Are they going to be able to start laying off that pitch? I mean, you know, it's fascinating. That's what's fascinating about baseball. You would expect both those guys to keep getting better. They're both going to win Rookie of the Year, and you expect rookies of the year to get better. But I don't know. I mean, it's going to take some real adjustment.
One of the weirdest aspects of the World Series, given that it was seven games long and there were so many incredible moments, is if you actually look at it, if you look at the stats, there weren't a lot of hitters who had good series at all.
No.
There really weren't. Obviously, Springer was a monster. Springer was seemingly up every inning and homering every inning of every game. That's what it seemed like. Other than Springer, there were only, and obviously all the small sample size, alarm bells should be going off, blah, 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 blah. But there were only two hitters on the Astros who had an OPS over 800. And one of them was Evan Gattis, who only got up 10 times. So, you know, and the other one was Correa. But, and like these guys who you feel like were you know, dominated the series, they didn't. Like, they really didn't. Gurriel, Bregman, Gonzalez, Altuve, these guys did not have. Josh Reddick, you know, had a terrible postseason. Jose Altuve had six hits in seven games.
Yeah.
And by the way, two of them were doubles and two of them were homers. So he had two doubles, two homers, and two singles in 31 at-bats. He had 194. His OPS was 670 in the series. And the same is true of the Dodgers, except for, you know, Culberson was 3-for-5 in five games. That doesn't really count. Right. Jock Peterson was the only semi-regular who really had a great series. Other than that, I mean, Chris Taylor had a 751 OPS, and he was the only guy who played in all seven games who was even over 750.
Oh, yeah.
And he was 751. I mean, Justin Turner had a bad series. Corey Seager had a bad series. Kike Hernandez had a bad series. Bellinger was nowheresville. Bellinger struck out 17 times in 28 at-bats. I mean, that's horrifying.
Yeah, horrifying.
Puig couldn't hit. Puig had four hits in seven games. Austin Barnes had four hits. By the way, what happened to Yasmani Grandal? Why wasn't Grandal hitting? Why was he never in the game? You texted me when they let Kershaw hit after the third inning, after his third inning of work, or maybe his second inning of work. He let off that inning. They let him hit. You know, they ended that game. I mean, I know it was 5-1 and they couldn't do anything, but they ended that game with Grandal on the bench. Grandal never got into that game. Grandal had 22 home runs this year. Like, don't you have to, you have to empty, in the same way you have to empty your bullpen, you have to empty your bench. You can't end that game with any halfway decent hitter not having gotten up. And when they finally did pinch it, somebody was Chase Utley, who isn't nearly the hitter that Grandal is. There were some very legitimately weird moments of managing in that last game. And I know it's hard in a series when your bullpen hasn't performed to expectation. You have Kershaw in the game and he's cruising. I get the instinct to let him pitch, but my goodness, you ended that game with a major league hitter, a good one with power, having not come to the plate. I think that's a huge mistake. That was just a weird miscalculation.
I think so too, but I got to say, I tweeted that. I didn't tweet specifically because it was actually with two outs that Kershaw came up. There was two outs and nobody on base, which is a very, very low leverage.
I thought he let off, but
It was two outs and nobody on base. And I what I wrote, and I was specifically tweeting for one reason. I was specifically tweeting to say, these guys have such short benches that they really don't have a lot of options because they go with 13, 12 pitchers, and so they only have 13 hitters. It's only, you know, only four or five guys on the bench, and one is your backup catcher. You can't do a whole lot with that guy. And so it's a weird kind of situation. But I tweeted, you know, that it's really sad because you're down five runs. They were down 5-0 at the time. You're down five runs, and you're letting your pitcher hit. And a bunch of people wrote in, I mean a bunch, saying I was insane. I was insane. You can't sit down Kershaw there. The most important thing is run prevention, blah, blah, blah. Which I love Clayton Kershaw. And I was thrilled to see him pitch well, although I'm not giving him full marks. I thought the Astros were absolutely going through the motions at the plate. But he got four innings of no run ball. It was awesome. Great for him. I was thrilled for him. So what? They were down 5-0. I mean, you've got, you know, and even Joe Sheehan, who I'm obviously a huge fan of Joe's, Joe made the point that it was a very low leverage situation and a pinch hitter doesn't give you much more of a chance. It doesn't matter. You're down five runs. You've got to take every opportunity to try to score a run. They have the top of the lineup coming up after that. Get a guy on base, a home run, even two runs in that situation is a huge, huge deal. And I think it was just a, I thought it was a mistake. Nobody seems to agree with me, and that's okay. I'm not. You know, look. It sounded like I was insulting Kershaw or something. I love Clayton Kershaw, but down five runs, I'm not letting a pitcher hit. In the Game 7 of the World Series, there's no chance I'm letting a pitcher hit. Any situation, any time. And your point about Grandal never giving to the plate is a great example of why. I mean, that's,
yeah, your season is whatever, 15 outs, has 15
right.
outs left
that's
in
right.
it. And by hitting Kershaw, you're conceding an out. And I know that you're, again, like, I get it. Your bullpen has not done as well as you would have liked in the last few games. But, you know, look, in Game 6, they held the Astros to one run. Like, you know, Game 5, they got destroyed and beaten up, including Kenley. You know, Kenley had been knocked around. A bunch of guys had been knocked around. But the day before, in that same stadium, your bullpen pitched pretty well after pulling your starter after 4 2/3. I mean, just the off chance that Grandal could homer
right.
is worth it, right? It's like
any run at that point.
Yeah,
is so big.
I know. And especially when the top of the inning is coming up, or the top of the order is coming up next, you know, if he can single and then you get Chris Taylor, who's got power, if you get Chris Taylor to the plate and he maybe puts one out, suddenly it's a completely different game. I know it's all what if, but like, that's the game you have to play. When there's 15 outs left in your season and you're down by five runs, you have to play that game.
I think so too.
I think it was crazy to not, even if you want to hit Utley there, fine, hit Utley there and save your backup catcher, do a double switch later, whatever. But I don't know. I just don't think when you're down by five and you've been suffocated, and by the way, you only scored three runs in the last game, so it's not like you're expecting an offensive explosion anytime soon. It was a very odd managerial decision, I thought.
I thought so, too. By the way, Chase Utley was 0 for 19 in the postseason.
Oof.
0 for 19. I mean...
Have we seen the last of Chase Utley?
I kind of hope the answer is yes. I mean, if Chase Utley wants to be a backup and you could stay in the game as long as you want, I'm not down on that. Chase Utley was a great player. I mean, really, truly a great player in his prime. And it's kind of sad to watch him now. I mean, from a fan's perspective, I never, ever would tell a player to retire. Play every minute you can. Get every dollar you can get out of this game. But it is sad watching Chase Utley now. I mean, they sent him to the plate, and I turned to the person next to me, and I went, no chance. No chance.
Chase, and they had two of those guys because they picked up Granderson, and we went to a couple games late in the year.
Yeah, same
and
thing.
He just looked lost too. And I remember when Granderson played on the Yankees, I was thinking, like, that is the best athlete I've ever seen, that guy. Like, he just looked so good at being athletic. And then, of course, is like universally adored and admired by everybody.
Soul. Yeah, wonderful.
And it was sad to watch him flail with the team to the point where they couldn't even justify putting him on the roster. That was a bummer.
It was a bummer. And look, again, and I can't blame him because he looked even worse than Chase Utley during the playoffs. But in a real world, you wouldn't carry 12 pitchers for a 7-game series. You would, in the old days, you would have a spot that you would put him on just off chance he gives you a Kirk Gibson like moment, but they couldn't do it because the way the game has changed. So all right, well, we're going to go on to our draft here, but before we do, Mike, anything on your mind?
No, I don't think so.
All right, let's go on to the draft then.
Oh wait, you know what? I'm sorry. There is one thing I wanted to get off my chest. It's
okay.
Small.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, I could say it. I couldn't. I'll just go ahead and say it.
All right, go ahead.
Here it is. I wanted to take a moment to tell you about the Cut Forecast. Now, the Cut Forecast is the podcast from the staff of MLB.com's Cut 4 section, which focuses on the lighter side of baseball. If you've made it this far into our podcast, we really think you'll enjoy it. This week's episode got a little emotional about the Astros' long-awaited World Series win, then debated whether Carlos Correa's on-field marriage proposal makes it more or less appropriate for fans to follow suit. Anyway, the point is, search Cut Forecast, that's C-U-T, the number 4, C-A-S-T, in Apple Podcasts or wherever else you get your podcasts and click subscribe. And now, Joe, on with the show.
On with the show. I'm so glad that you got that off your chest.
I could have not said anything. I could have just kept it to myself, but I don't know. Why not? It's like the last podcast of the baseball season, so I figured why not? I'll just
absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. By the way, you did not this week. Nothing was really on your mind about the StatCast podcast, which you've never said, in a row. But I will tell you that StatCast podcaster Mike Petriello wants a long series of Jacksonville Jaguar jokes on The Good Place. He would like to see just literally half an hour of nothing but Jacksonville.
Just nothing but Jacksonville Jaguar jokes. Yeah. All right.
For those of you who certainly watch the Good Place every Thursday at what 8:30? Is it 8:30?
Yeah. Well, the eighth episode aired last night, and now we're off the air for a couple months because of football. We come back in January with our ninth episode. But the way I see it is just more opportunity for you to catch up if you haven't seen all the episodes yet.
That's true. Although, yet another reason to be depressed. Another couple months. That's without right. The Good Place. But in The Good Place, one of the great characters, Jason, is a Jacksonville Jaguars fan, which is awesome in all ways.
Yeah.
And I'm not to give anything away, certainly not, but at one point in one of the shows, he asks, did the Jacksonville Jaguars win the Super Bowl? And he was told no. And he said, will the Jacksonville Jaguars ever win the Super Bowl? At which point Ted Danson said, you know, I can't predict the future, but... No.
But no, they won't. Yeah.
that is the truest statement ever. They're never winning the Super Bowl ever.
I don't know. They got a real good defense this year, apparently.
They're the Jacksonville. No, they probably do, but they're the Jacksonville Jaguars. It's not going to happen. All right. We are drafting. We're going to draft players. How about this? It's like we're going back to the roots of what drafts are supposed to be in the first place.
You've come all the way around and we're back at the beginning. And we're just drafting baseball players.
We're going to draft baseball players. We're drafting players from the World Series. And that's it. I mean, we're not necessarily drafting the best players, which is sort of the players that we got the most enjoyment out of during this World Series. Is that right?
That's exactly right. I would say that's right. Yes.
All right. So I guess I got the first pick. So right. I'll start. And it's the first pick's obvious. I mean, I think this is going to be really fun because I think we're going to get some cool players. But no question, the player who blew my mind during this series was George Springer. And that's obvious. He was the MVP. I have seen plenty of George Springer play through the years. I mean, just flipping channels, catching Astros games here and there. Obviously, when they got good during the playoffs, watching George Springer, and I always thought, you know, this is what a talent, right? What a good player. I mean, he's obviously a good outfielder. He's got good speed. He's got power. He's a leadoff hitter. You know, he's sort of in the mold of that five-tool player. I had no idea the guy was Superman. I just didn't know until this postseason. He started this postseason with a 4-strikeout game. He struck out 4 times in game 1, and this was coming off of a, I would call it disastrous, American League Championship Series against the Yankees, where he hit nothing. He didn't hit at all. And my thought was, wow, George Springer, you know, and there was, I was there in the press conferences when people were asking manager A.J. Hinch if he was going to bench him or move him down in the lineup or something. I mean, it was that bad. And Hinch, you know, to his credit, said, no, of course not. He's our leadoff hitter. I'm going to stick with him, and he'll have more good days than bad days. And then I don't think he missed a pitch the last six games. It was one of the craziest, you know, because it wasn't just that he hit whatever, he hit 400 for the series or whatever. Every ball was just crushed. Just crushed. He didn't hit little cheapy home runs. Every one of his home runs was just this monstrous, gargantuan shot. He hit the home run in game 5 that went up to the upper, like, little deck over the left field wall where they have the cannon. So it actually, if you watch it on replay, it looks like that home run actually sets off the cannon, which is awesome. What a player. What a player. I mean, it's really, to see an athlete that good is one thing, but to see a player that locked in, especially coming off of the 4-strikeout game where he was just, you couldn't throw a pitch by him. Even the last out he made was like a rocket to center field. He just was so locked in. I'm blown away. I was just blown away by George Springer.
Yeah, we all thought this was going to be Altuve's coming out party or Correa's coming out party. It was George Springer's. And by the way, I mean, look at his regular season stats. He had 34 home runs as a leadoff hitter. He had an 889 OPS. He scored 112 runs. He's He's great. He's truly great. Yeah. And by the way, I should say, I as a point of pride, New Britain, Connecticut in the house. I'm from I grew up in West Hartford. New Britain is, you know, 15, 20 minutes away. It's where the New Britain Red Sox used to play. I think there's now a different AA franchise there. I used to go to New Britain all the time. It's weirdly, I take a weird amount of pride in the World Series MVP being from Central Connecticut, a place where no one is ever from, except for, weirdly, by the way, Jeff Bagwell, also from that
Bagwell,
area.
That's so, right.
Two great Astros from Central Connecticut. Anyway, yeah, I mean, everything he did, with the exception of diving for that triple, misjudging that triple and that first game, every single thing he did was amazing. You're right. Even his outs were like rocket line drives. I believe he hit that rocket line drive that who was it? Chris Taylor maybe had to like run and slide and every time he came up, Dodger Stadium was very upset. It was just, you could feel it.
Well, and I didn't feel that for anybody else. I really didn't.
Nobody scared you. Even when Correa and Altuve homered in game two, like that didn't set them off. I mean, you know, they had legit, like Altuve had a bad series offensively. Especially for him. I mean, I know he hit two home runs. He had a straight up bad series. He did not do what we all thought he was going to do, which is dominate in that way that he dominates so wonderfully. So I am not picking either of those guys with my number one pick. I'm going to pick Alex Bregman. Alex Bregman had an okay series offensively. He was okay. He had a couple homers and he was 7-for-30 out of the two hole. A couple homers, he drove in some runs and, you know, but I'm picking him because of his defense. That guy played incredible defense at third, and in a very unflashy way, he made every play. He made plays where he came in on the ball. He made plays where he went to his left. He made plays where he went to his right. He was in, you know, the Astros pulled some pretty crazy shifts. He made plays where he was essentially playing shortstop. And obviously he was in the middle of that crazy game five rally. He got the winning hit. I just was like, he got lost on this team hitting second in a lineup where Springer hits first and then Altuve hits third and then Correa hits fourth. He was completely lost. I knew who he was. I knew he existed on earth. I did not know anything about him. I was super impressed watching him play. I think he's 23 years old and he secretly is like such an important part of that team. He's not flashy. He's not a guy that your eye is naturally drawn to. But as a 23-year-old in the regular season, he hit 19 home runs. He had an 827 OPS. He scored 88 runs. He stole 17 bases, which, by the way, here's the weirdest thing about Springer. You know how many bases, without looking, how many bases did George Springer steal in the regular season at 140 games?
I know it wasn't a lot. I looked it up at some point and I knew it was.
He stole five
less
bases.
Than 10 maybe.
Doesn't it seem like that guy should be like a 30-30 guy? Like, I just like, that's how good an athlete he is you would just assume that he's really fast. I guess he's not that fast a runner or doesn't have a good technique or something.
Or doesn't run.
Altuve had 32. The point is, I Bregman wasn't the flashiest guy in the series, and he didn't have the best series, but I just suddenly became aware of what an amazing player he is, so I'm picking him first.
He was so fantastic. I mean, just defensively, and he scares you offensively. I mean, look, I'm never ever going to forget the play that he made against the Yankees in the ALCS.
I mean, incredible.
The throw to the plate. Incredible, incredible. And then he had a play. It was not nearly as amazing, but similarly built, where he beat threw home on a ground ball when the guy left on contact. And it was an easier play. He was coming in and whatever, but it still was that's not an easy play. He's terrific. Bregman is terrific. And that's a really, really good choice. With my second pick, I am going to go with, I'm going to go with Charlie Morton. That's what I'm going to go with. We talked a little bit about Charlie Morton before Game 7. I think we both thought there was a chance he was going to be the guy in Game 7, which it turned out he was. I don't get Charlie Morton at all. I don't. I don't understand how he does what he does. He's always been a fascinating guy. You might remember, like, I don't know, maybe 3 or 4 years ago when he was with the Pirates, maybe even a little longer, he decided to completely mirror Roy Halladay. Like, he had studied Roy Halladay film, and he decided to do, like, a frame-by-frame, like, psycho rebuild of Roy Halladay's swing. I don't know, the pitching motion, I mean. I don't know if you remember that, but, I mean, they were showing video of him and Halladay, and it was precise. I mean, it really was, like, better than the psycho, like, cut for cut, you know, shot for shot. And I was just like, well, this guy is quirky, you know, it's weird. And like, he was a good pitcher. He was pretty good. He was good with the Pirates. He never could stay really healthy. He never really could get you 30 starts. But he was good. He was solid, and then he was no good, and then he was solid again, and then he was no good. And then he went to Philadelphia and, you know, whatever. And then he came this year, and he was really, really good, first of all, this year. But suddenly he was a power pitcher, suddenly throwing 97 and with a nasty breaking ball, and like, where did that come from? Suddenly he's striking out 10 batters every 9 innings. I mean, the guy had never was a strikeout pitcher at all in entire career. It was weird. And then he just came into game 7 and just took it over. Just flat took it over. And you did sense a little bit of desperation on the Dodgers' part, which I think he played into. But he came into that game, it was over. It was just over. The Dodgers never even, like, posed even, like, the slightest threat to him. And, yeah, I mean, that's impressive. It's impressive. So he's the guy that I'm picking number two.
In order for the Astros to win the series, to get past the Yankees and then to win the series, he was exactly the kind of guy that needed to step up. Like, yeah. Because you expect, like, Verlander and Keuchel to be good, and you expect Altuve and Correa, whoever, to be good. But in order to get over the hump of the Yankees and then to win, to beat a team as good as the Dodgers, Morton is exactly the kind of guy who needs to emerge, and he totally did. He showed up in Game 7 against the Yankees. He showed up again in the series. Like, it's a team sport, and we all know that. And what that really means is, like, the guys who can go either way, who might be good and might be bad, they need to be good, and he was one of those guys. And he threw 5 innings against the Yankees of, like, 2-hit ball in Game 7. He threw whatever it was, 4 innings in the Game 7 against the Dodgers, 3 innings, whatever it was, and shut them down. Like, that is ultimately, like, as big a deal as, you know, as any home run that anybody hit.
Yeah, that's right.
In fact, it's a bigger deal, obviously. It's a good choice. He was probably going to be my next pick. Instead, I'll go to the Dodgers. I'm going to pick Jock Peterson. I don't particularly like Jock Peterson. I think it's probably psychological because his name is Jock. Like, his name is the thing that he is, right? He is a very jocky guy. But I'm picking him not just because he had a really good series. He had 3 home runs. He also was the only guy to try to beat the shift. He ended up hitting a home run to left. I should point out, I would be remiss if I didn't point out that if Yasiel Puig had done what Jock Peterson did when he hit those home runs, there would have been 1,000 think pieces about how Yasiel Puig is disrespecting the game. And because Jock Peterson is a white guy, there were none. I just wanted to point that out. But after watching this team now for many years, and especially this year, the thing that made the Dodgers so good all year was they had all of these guys, all of these different guys who kept having really good runs of like 3, 4, 5 weeks at the plate. You know, they have these guys, Chris Taylor and Logan Forsythe, they picked up and you know, Turner, there are guys that were good all year. Turner was good all year. Seager was good all year, whatever. But then they would have these guys, Kike Hernandez and Austin Barnes and Grandal and all these different guys who would just get on these like really hot streaks and kind of carry the team from the margins of the lineup. And it was fun to watch Jock Peterson do that because Jock Peterson, you know, he burst onto the scene. He hit 20 home runs really fast in his rookie year. And then suddenly there was a giant hole in his swing and he couldn't hit anything. And the Dodgers got a bunch of good outfielders. You know, they had Chris Taylor, and they had, you know, Bellinger plays in the outfield sometimes, and they had Puig and Wright, and they had Andrew Toles, who got injured, unfortunately. And Peterson was sort of like an odd man out. And it was kind of fun to see, after having watched the team for so long, it was fun to see him reemerge and get hot and kind of come through with some big hits. And, you know, he's not my favorite player on the team, but when he's good, he's really good. And it was fun to watch him get hot and to drive a few balls into the stands.
Yeah, I agree. You know, and the story with him and his brother is very cool. And I mean, there's some stuff to like there. He was really good.
Yeah.
I mean, and that felt to me, there was something, you know, even extra fairy tale-ish in some ways about that. You know, obviously him getting sent to the minors and all of that in the comeback. When he hit the first home run, you thought, oh, that's a nice moment.
Right.
Nice moment for the guy. Good for him. Good for Jock Peterson. And then you're like, I'd never expect to see that again.
Yeah.
But he kind of did it all series. He really did.
Yeah.
I mean, at some point, if you were a Dodgers fan, especially, you know, game 6 and 7, he's the guy you wanted at the plate.
Yeah. Isn't that crazy? In that lineup with those hitters, he was the guy that people got were like, ooh, he basically did what you thought Bellinger was going to do, right?
Or Seager. Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, he was, you know, the home runs he hit. I mean, the opposite field one was a weird one, but the other two were bombs.
Yeah.
I mean, it was, you know, I that's a good pick. That's a good pick. With my third pick, I'm going to go to the Dodgers as well. I'm going to take, and this is for a little bit weirder reason, but I'm going to take Rich Hill.
Ah, shoot. I almost took him. I almost took him last pick. I thought I could sneak him in the third round.
Rich Hill was really fun to watch this series for a lot of reasons. But one of the reasons for me watching Rich Hill this series was there's never a time Rich Hill goes out there that I don't expect him to get ripped. There's never a time. Every time he goes out, and it's not like Rich Hill has bad stuff. Rich Hill is a huge strikeout, you know, guy this year and all that. But he's 37, and it's been a weird career and long, and he kind of came back, and then he was gone again. And then, you know, obviously he's had some health, you know, things that he's overcome. And I just go out there, and I'm like, oh, boy, they're going to score 4 runs in the first off of him and end this. And they never did. They never really did. And nobody really ever does against Rich Hill. It's like you can get guys on base and it looks like you're going to get them. And then he'll find some way to get like a little dribbler back to the mound or something and get out of the inning. There's something kind of artistic about it, about the way he does that. I thought he was a lot of fun. I really thought he was a lot of fun to watch this series. There was a weird feeling watching Kershaw pitch. Every time you watch Kershaw pitch in the postseason, or at least I did, you're like, oh, please don't get beat up, right? Don't get hit, because then everybody's going to be out there talking about the stupid narrative that you can't get people out. So there was like a tension, but it's like when he got people out, there was like, fine, good. Another inning that nobody's going to be talking about. Clayton Kershaw can't win. Rich Hill, it was the exact opposite. Every out he got felt like a little miracle. It was like, this is awesome. Look at that, guys. So,
it's a good
loved
pick.
It. So Rich Hill's my third pick.
He also did the awesome thing of stepping off the mound to let the Dodger Stadium crowd boo.
Oh, my God.
Uriel. when after the racial incident, that was awesome. I loved him for that. I thought that was great and super cool. There's an argument to be made. He was the most valuable pitcher on the Dodgers, even though he kept getting pulled early. I feel like Dave Roberts feels like you do, which is like, this guy's going to get rocked. Meanwhile, he threw 8 2/3 innings, gave up 7 hits and struck out 12, and he only gave up 2 runs. I mean, he pitched really well in the series. You know, there's the best Dodger pitcher probably the series was Alex Wood, which is insane. It's an insane thing to say, but Alex Wood threw 7 2/3 innings and gave up 1 hit. Hindsight is 20/20, but it's possible they should have started him in Game 7. Anyway, the point is, Rich Hill is the best. I love Rich Hill. I wish he's the guy that like you wish had gotten that ring. For the Dodgers, more than Kershaw, you wish it for different reasons. But Rich Hill, it would have been a great story. He's pitched for 40 different teams in 11 years. It would have been nice.
Yeah. By the way, some By the way, more than one person tweeted me or texted me, somewhat feeling like it was not cool what Rich Hill did to Gurriel, where he stepped off the mound and let the fans boo for even longer. And the thing I loved about it, I mean, the thing I loved is he did it in such a way where there would be no mistake that that's what he was doing.
That's right.
Like, he didn't pretend like he's walking around, like, pretend to do that and, you know, secretly want the... No, he would stand behind the mound and, like, just stand there doing nothing while the fans booed him. So it was clear. And, of course, afterward, he said that's what he was doing as well. And there were a couple of people. There was one specifically, seemed like a decent guy, was like, well, that's not cool. You know, look, what Gurriel did was wrong. But it was, you know, this is a cultural thing. And I just didn't think that was cool. I think we're too sensitive about such things. And I'm like, if we're too sensitive about this, why in the world would you blame Rich Hill for letting the fans boo? That seems to me like that's exactly what sensitivity, you shouldn't feel any sensitivity. Like, that, like, let the fans boo. Why are you sensitive about that?
I thought the moment that he let them boo was great. And I also, by the way, we should say, when Gurriel came up in game 7 against Darvish, he tipped his cap to him.
He sure did.
And that was cool. That was a cool thing for him to do. And by the way, I feel like this is all good. Like, this stuff should not be kept quiet and under wraps and internal. I think you gotta, like, when things like this happen, everybody's got to speak up and say, yeah, this is ugly and sad and gross, and, like, let's talk it out and get it out and all express our feelings. And I think it leads to moments like Gurriel stepping into that box and tipping his cap to Darvish.
I thought Gurriel, look, what Gurriel did, we all know what he did. I thought Gurriel, and by the way, his original initial apology was dreadful. It was dreadful. It was awful. And the Astros put out a press release that basically said something like about perceived something. It was awful. It was just awful. So, like, the first day, nobody really knew how to handle it. But I thought by the second day, everybody kind of had their arms around it. And I thought Gurriel, like, he took it. Like, the fans booed him. He didn't like kind of. He didn't say, hey, they shouldn't be booing me.
He didn't get super macho and defensive, whatever. He was like, okay, yeah, I did a stupid thing. It's offensive and gross. And I'm going to tip my – I deserve it. Yeah, I weirdly – it was a tiny little dumb subplot of the World Series. But I thought that when it came to an end with Gurriel tipping his cap to Darvish, I was like, okay, that the world is now a better place than it was a day ago. Yeah,
I agree.
My third pick, I'm going to pick Charlie Culberson.
Nice.
Okay, so Charlie Culberson. Here's some information about Charlie Culberson. Charlie Culberson got up to the plate during the regular season 13 times.
Right.
He had 13 at-bats in the regular season. In those 13 at-bats, he had 2 hits. Neither of those hits was a home run. In the World Series, he got up 5 times, had 3 hits, and one of them was a home run. He had more hits in 5 at-bats in the World Series than he did the entire regular season. The joy on his face when he ran around the bases after hitting that home run is one of the best moments in any World Series that I can remember, certainly for a team that didn't end up winning the game or the series. That was, you would have to say. But I loved that moment. That moment to me is what, when this World Series kicked into high gear from being interesting to, like, oh my God, this is something, this could be something very weird and special. I love that for the rest of his life, Charlie Culberson, who had 13 total at-bats for the entire season, I love the fact that he hit a home run in the World Series. I love the fact that he was that exuberant about it, that we will see the tape of that. We'll see that moment played over and over and over again forever and ever and ever. It'll be played at Dodger Stadium between innings forever and ever and ever. Like, it was just a wonderful World Series moment from an unlikely guy. You go back in time in your head and think about whoever you want to think about, Mark Lemke or Ozzie Smith's home run or whoever, and find those guys who just are the 25th guy on the roster who managed to have a big World Series moment. That is what the World Series is all about. It's what makes baseball great. Love that guy. Congratulations. Number 3 pick.
Love it. Love it. Love the fact that a couple of people were kind of grumpy about him doing that. And his response was, I just hit a home run.
Don't
the
care.
World Series.
Do not care about you.
Don't. Not going to not do that ever. No, that's a World Series home run for me. That's awesome. Love that guy. Yeah, I thought that was awesome. That game was incredible. I mean, game 5 is the wildest game I've ever seen. Game two was just mind-blowing. It was so good. It was just, and that was, you know, again, he hit the home run, and they lost the game, you like, 5 minutes later, right? Because it was the next guy, was Puig. And it didn't matter. It still was just an incredible, amazing
one. By the way, Charlie Culberson, in his so his in his career, he has a 57 OPS plus. He's a 231 hitter with a 57 OPS plus, right? In the postseason in 14 games, he's a 348 batting average with a 986 OPS and a 652 slugging percentage. He's 8-for-23 in his postseason career in three series. He's 8-for-23 with two doubles, a triple, and a homer. He's a postseason hero. Oh, now for the you've awesome. Got to put that guy on your roster if he's ever on your team. You've got to get that guy to the postseason. He mashes in the postseason.
And the only reason he was even on the team is because Corey Seager got hurt. That was they otherwise he wouldn't have even been on. And then he had that such a good you know championship series. They were like, we got to put him on the World Series roster, even though Seager's bad.
Throw him in there. He plays 100 positions. Let him play, and then he hits a home run in the World Series. It's the best.
Let him play. It's so awesome. So awesome. That guy will never have to buy another beer in L.A. Right? I mean, that you got to think.
I don't think that's true of him. I think he would have had – the Dodgers would have had to have won.
They would have had to win, and the homer would have had to matter.
That's right.
Probably. But if he told people, I'm Charlie Culberson, they might give
him. No, most people in L.A. would be like, I don't know who that is.
What movie were you in? All right, my fourth pick you know what? I'm going to go with Justin Verlander. There's kind of a specific reason. Look, Verlander was very good in the postseason. I mean, he was excellent in the postseason. He was very good in the World Series. He didn't win either of his games, I guess, by win thing, whatever. But he pitched very, very well and all of that. But there's a very specific reason that I'm picking him. I was thinking a lot about every time he pitched, I would think, you know, the folk tale of John Henry, right? So John Henry was the whatever steel, you know, pounding the steel and trying to build tunnels through for the railroad, and eventually he was the best. He was the best at whatever that's called, and then they built a machine, a steam engine that could do it, and he raced against the steam engine and he beat the steam engine, but then he died, right? So this is like the folk tale of man against machine or whatever. It feels to me like Justin Verlander is like the folktale of man against machine. It's like everybody else out there is, you start in the postseason, you know exactly what you're doing. You're going to pitch 5 innings, 4 innings, 3 innings. You're going to face two of the batters twice. You know, you're going to go through the order twice. You're not going to get a third time. And then there's this guy who's like from another time and another place who just is, you know, he's just like grandfathered in. I mean, it's insane. And it's fun to have him in. He had the only complete game of this postseason. I think the only postseason, we're not going to see another complete game in the postseason, I don't think, not for a long time. He had it, he should have had it. So I'm going to go with Justin Verlander with my fourth pick.
Yeah, I'm happy for that guy. He's been, you know, he had 18 months where he wasn't right. And he, you know, that midseason trade, I like it when guys who were traded at the trade deadline end up actually doing the thing that the team got them for, you know?
He actually did it.
He carried them. They were shaky. They were the shakiest 100-win team in a long time, and the reason they were shaky is because they basically had Dallas Keuchel and no one else in their rotation. Right. They had a bunch of question marks, and you get that guy, and he shows up and does what he... I mean, he was 12-0 until he lost... game six, he was 12-0 as an Astro, right? Like he just never lost. He was suddenly back to the old Justin Verlander. And I think that's right. Isn't that what he was? I don't think he had gotten a loss for the Astros, whatever he was. I don't think he had gotten a loss since he'd been picked up. And I just like it when that guy, you know, he's been in the league a long time. He's thrown no hitters. He's been in the middle of some playoff runs, whatever. Then suddenly he becomes the guy. He became their guy. And he earned his money, and he earned his. He got everything that he did, everything for the team that they thought he might do, and that's cool.
That's cool.
Yeah. All right, my fourth pick, I'm going to do something controversial, and I'm going to pick Clayton Kershaw.
Okay.
I don't care. I don't care what anybody says. Clayton Kershaw's the best. Clayton Kershaw's the best pitcher in baseball. Clayton Kershaw, something very weird happens to Clayton Kershaw in the postseason. Everyone talks, we've talked about it. You talk about the home runs, right? Clayton Kershaw, it seems like he gives up a ton of home runs in the postseason. He's given up 18 home runs in his career in the postseason in 122 innings. That's certainly a higher ratio than the number of home runs that he gives up in the regular season. The weirdest, slightly weirder thing to me is the walks. Clayton Kershaw walks a lot of dudes in the postseason. And obviously, look, the hitters are much better, right? Like the but in the regular season this year, he had 202 strikeouts and 30 walks. Last year in 2016, he had 172 strikeouts and 11 walks. He had last year in 2016, you know, he was missed time, obviously, because he was hurt. He had 12 wins and 11 walks. He never walks anyone. That's his whole thing, is he doesn't walk people.
Right.
In his postseason career, he has 139 strikeouts and 37 walks. Yeah. So basically, it's like a 3.5-to-1 strikeout-to-walk ratio, whereas in his life, in his career, it's 4-to-1 or 5-to-1. Some in the year, in 2016, it was whatever, 17-to-1. Like I do not understand it, and I never will. No one ever will. The funny thing is, if you actually look at his postseason record, his WHIP, his career WHIP in the postseason is 1.098, which is pretty darn good.
Really good.
His career WHIP in is basically exactly one, almost exactly one. So he's, you know, it's not like wildly different. It's just that he does a thing in the postseason that he doesn't usually do in the regular season, which is he has disaster innings. He has these innings where he just cannot get anyone out. And, you know, he'll obviously game one, he was brilliant. He was characteristically brilliant. We all thought the narrative was dead forever. Then he surrendered both a 4-run lead and a 3-run lead in the same game in game 5. And that just doesn't happen. I just don't understand it. I hate it. I wish it weren't the case, you know? And then he comes back and throws 4 innings on 2 days rest of almost perfect relief. He walked 2 guys, both intentional. But other than that, he gave up 2 dribbler singles. And it's like, I really, really wish that he had shut down the Astros in game 5 and this narrative could be dead forever, because it's like any narrative. It's like, you know, Sergio Garcia has never won a major. Phil Mickelson has never won a major. Dan Marino never won a Super Bowl. It's one of these dumb things that we have to live with, and it will not end until it ends. It just won't end until it's over. It's like, and I thought after game 1, I was like, okay, this is it. They're going to win in 5 games. He's going to win game 5. That'll be it. And it's just such a bummer. I really hate it.
It is. No, it is. It's a bummer. It's just a total bummer. You know, there are times he's really, really good in the postseason. It's not a consistent thing. He was really good in game 1, but he's had other games. He was good against the Cubs. Sometimes he's really good. He never quite feels like, I mean, game 1 was about as close as I've seen it, where he's the overwhelming dominant Kershaw. You know, there always feels like there's something weird, like I don't even know what to say. It's almost like there's like a little, like a window, there's just like a little film on it or something. I mean, it's just, something's just a little bit off, and I don't know what it is, and maybe it's nothing. Maybe it's just, this is what happens when you only play against good teams, because, I mean, let's face it, that's a big deal. That's a big deal that you're only facing good lineups every single game rather than getting, you know, half of your games being against mediocre teams. So I don't know exactly what it is, but
I don't either, man. I really hate it. I really hate it.
I really don't like it. Yeah. Well, but, you know, this is, he'll get other chances. I mean, that's the thing. That Dodgers team isn't going anywhere. He's gonna have other chances.
The craziest thing is that his WHIP in this in the World Series was 0.89. I mean, it's 2 innings. It's really, in the entire time he pitched, it was 2, and he had 2 bad innings. He gave up 4 runs, then he gave up, and then he basically put 2 guys on, and then those runs both scored on a home run off Maeda's, which, so it's not even like they're totally his fault. But other than that, I mean, he threw 15 2/3 innings and struck out 17 guys. That's right in line with what he usually does. He walked five guys, which is a couple more than maybe you would expect.
But a couple were intentional, as you mentioned.
Well, there were two intentional and five unintentional. It's 10 strikeouts per nine innings. It's in a 0.89 whip. That is Kershaw. That's who he is. It's just that those two innings, if he doesn't give up that three-run bomb to Gurriel. Was it Gurriel hit that three-run homer off him? And then he, you know, he just walks two guys in the same inning. That never happens. It's just... He has it's individual innings. It's not like obviously we all remember those games where he, you know, was cruising and then against St. Louis and then suddenly it's like seven runs or whatever in one inning. It's just weird. It's really weird. And I can't explain it.
It's bizarre. It is bizarre. All right. With my fifth pick, I'm going to go completely off the board. And I'm going to take Carlos Beltran. Not for anything he did during the series, because he did nothing. I think he came up three times and didn't get a hit. But this is probably the end for Carlos Beltran. It's probably the end of his career. It's been a fantastic career and one that I have watched very closely since the beginning. I was columnist in Kansas City when he first came up as a 21-year-old kid. And, you know, watch this guy just turn into... you know, really a superstar, just an absolute superstar. In his younger days, he could do everything. I mean, he was he stole bases. He never got caught. His percentage of stolen bases, even now, even at the end of his career, you look at it, it's insane. But at the time, it was historic. I mean, he would steal 9 out of 10 bases for you, minimum. Had power, played incredible defense, was just a guy that did everything. He was amazing. First few years he did it for Kansas City, nobody cared, nobody noticed. Went to Houston the first time and had that insane postseason. Remember that?
He earned himself about $50 million in about
$50 million from the Mets for what he did for basically, you know, nine games or whatever. But he had that insane World Series, you couldn't get him out. Incredible. Then he went to the Mets and for way too much money at the time, had kind of a mediocre year, and then had a spectacular year for the Mets. His second year was, you know, one of the best years in Mets history. Then had some other good years and then bounced around, but had other, just kind of stuck around for years as a good player for longer than I really ever thought he would. Just kind of kept hitting and kept hitting, added power. He stopped being that all-around player, but started, you know, giving you 25 home runs every year, basically. And now he's at the end of a career that I think he's going to have a very interesting Hall of Fame discussion about him. I think there are going to be people that are very much for him, people very much against him. But I think at the end, everybody was so happy for him that they were able to give him a World Series ring before he retired. So my fifth pick is Carlos Beltran.
It's a great choice. He's a great player. I was really happy for him. Really happy that he came all the way back around to Houston. He was crying very cutely and sweetly after they won. I am actually making my fifth pick for very similar reasons on the other side on the losing side, which is I'm picking Andre Ethier. Andre Ethier it was a really good baseball player. He's no longer a really good baseball player. He's an odd man out for the Dodgers. He's the longest tenured Dodger. He's sort of an odd man out in their outfield. He's 35 now. He hasn't played a lot in the last couple of years. He's been banged up. He's obviously very clearly not the same guy, but this is a guy who, you know, he hit 30 home runs one year in his prime. You know, he hit 20 a couple other times. He was a really good outfielder. He's a kind of a fan favorite in LA. He's probably done here. And I was just happy when he drove in that one run. I was just happy for him that he got to the World Series with the Dodgers. He drove in a run. Like, that was a cool moment. I thought that was a cool moment.
It really was.
And you know, like, he's been an All-Star a couple times. He won a Gold Glove. Like, he's also, by the way, the subject of one of my favorite ever articles I wrote for Fire Joe Morgan, the old baseball blog I used to write about bad sports writing. There was a Bill Plaschke piece about Andre Ethier, about the Dodgers scout who said they should trade for Andre Ethier. It was truly wonderful, in part because the premise of the article was that this old grizzled scout was like, you guys don't know this guy, Andre Ethier, but I've seen him play and you should you should trade for him. And then you Google Andre Ethier, and he'd been the Oakland A's minor league player of the year before. like everyone knew about Andre Ethier, but the premise of the article was like, you didn't, he was this weird hidden gem, you know. Meanwhile, he's like, you know, winning awards in the A's minor league system. Anyway, neither here nor there. I was happy for Ethier that he got to the World Series, that he was even on the roster, I thought was great. I was happy that he had a moment that he'll remember for the rest of his life, where he, you know, singled to right and drove in the only run of the game. I wish they kind of wish they could have won the series for him, among other people. But nonetheless, like, it was, he's at the end of the road with the Dodgers. He does not fit on this team at all. He can't really play anymore. And I was happy that he got a little moment. So I'll take him with my fifth pick.
I totally agree with you. The players like Andre Ethier are, in so many ways, kind of what baseball, you know, one of many things that baseball's kind of all about, where, you know, Andre Ethier's not a Hall of Famer. I mean, we know that. But he was a very, very good player for an extended period of time. Yeah. And a guy that in Los Angeles is kind of like a legend. Right? And every team has these guys. Like Kansas City had Mike Sweeney. Like, nobody cared about Mike Sweeney outside of Kansas City. But in Kansas City, he was the one guy that was hitting when that team was terrible and was just good every year, and he was great in the community, and you just loved him. You just loved the guy. And every city has these guys. Often they become broadcasters, right, by the way, for the team after they finish. But they're such an important part of baseball. So totally agree. I would not have been able to tell you that Andre Ethier has played 38 games for the Dodgers the last 2 years.
Yeah.
Combined. Right? I wouldn't have been able to tell you that. I mean, I just kind of thought, you know, oh boy, Andre Ethier. So it was kind of a surprise that he was on the postseason roster. And then, yeah, for him to come up with that hit, I actually thought that was the one, like, millisecond that I thought, hey, maybe
yeah, because when it here, after that know? Hit, it was first and second, and they had, I think there's one out, they had a little bit of momentum for the first time, and it felt like, right, if it was gonna happen, it was gonna happen there, and then obviously it didn't. Yeah.
It did not happen. No. So, all right. Well, that's our draft. So, I guess we got to finish this off with one last meaningless thing to end this meaningless thing.
It's one last meaningless thing to end this meaningless thing. We talk about sports and we draft things we know, like how beaches are terrible places to go. No hot fruit for Michael, more Diet Coke for Joe. The podcast, whoa, it's one last whoa, meaningless thing.
And I will let you go first.
So my son currently has an injury. He took a spill. He stepped on a basketball and it flew out from under his feet and he landed on his arm. He has a very, 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 very minor possible fracture in his elbow, but you know, he's in a soft cast and a sling that will probably come off in like 5 days. So it's really not a big deal, but I was looking for something to kind of like cheer him up. And by the way, as if going to game 7 of the World Series wasn't enough to cheer him up, right? But I still was like, cause he's going to, this weekend, he's going to, for the first time ever, miss a baseball game. He was on a Cal Ripken like streak for 2.5 years with his baseball team. He'd never missed a single game, and he's going to miss games this Sunday. And so I was looking for something to cheer him up. So I got tickets. My friend very kindly offered me tickets to the Clippers game, and he's a basketball fan. So we're going to go see the Clippers game. And so now we're going to this Clippers game, and it's totally for him to make him feel, and he's really excited or whatever. But I didn't realize how existentially empty it was going to be for me to go to a basketball game so soon after the end of baseball season. Like I'm acutely aware of how this means that there's no more baseball. And it just is like a real bummer. I'm just like, I can't get it. I'm obviously, I'm happy to go. I'm going to be fun. They're playing the Heat. They'll probably win. They're playing really well right now. It's going to be fun. Blah, 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 blah. But I'm bummed out that there's no more baseball.
Yeah. Well, I can't blame you, honestly, because and this is not specific to the Clippers, but you go to an LA Clippers game, baseball season's over.
Yeah.
That's right.
I mean, that's what that means.
That's what it is. That's exactly what that means. It's like it ought to actually be their slogan. Like, come to the Clippers, baseball season's over. Yeah, it's a bummer. It is just a bummer. I just, It feels like this winter is already here, by the way. I mean, like, it doesn't start till December 20th and the weather's not turned yet, obviously, but it feels like winter is upon us, and it is. It's a bummer. At least we have the awards, you know, at least we have some baseball awards to discuss over the next couple weeks.
Yes. But
it's not the same. No, I know. It's a bummer. All right. My one last meaningless thing. I think I might have this might be the best of the one last meaningless things. I know I'm saying that in advance, but I mean, this could not be more meaningless. So before game seven, I had to go down to the field and do an interview with Mad Dog Russo, Chris Russo. So in order to do that at Dodger Stadium, you kind of have to wind down a bunch of steps, and then you get out in the field and you get on the wrong side and you have to cross around, behind home plate and go all the way up down, you know, the first baseline. It's not that long a walk, but you have to kind of maneuver your way through. So I went down to the field before the game and got on the field, and I went behind home plate, and then there were a bunch of cameras that I kind of had to walk around. And then, I just have to say it. I should not say this, but I'm going to say it. I was walking toward there. I stepped on a rake. And the rake jumped up and bonked me in the head.
No way. You're kidding me.
So, this thing that has always been like a comedy trope that never does not exist, does not, nobody slips on banana peels and nobody steps on a rake and has it bonk them in the head. I stepped on a rake and it bonked me in the head.
I'm stunned into silence. I don't know what to say.
What can you say? And I was looking around like, oh my God, I hope nobody saw that. Oh my God, I can't. Of course, now I'm telling everybody, but I'm like, oh my God, I hope nobody saw that. And then, you know, then the rake went down and it didn't hurt. I mean, it kind of bonked me. I mean, it was shocking. It was like, whoa. And then the rake went down and I just stopped for a second and I went, I just stepped on a rake and it hit me in the head. I am now officially like in a Laurel and Hardy movie. This literally just happened.
That is truly stunning. This is, you're right. I was worried that you were overselling it, but that is the best. This is the best all time meaningless thing to end this meaningless thing. Congratulations. I think we should, I think we should retire the segment. I'm not kidding. I think we should. I think this should be the last one. We should come up with something else to do at the end of this silly hour and 30 minute podcast. We should retire it. I think this should be the end. This should be, you should have, let's walk off into the sunset with you stepping on a rake.
I think we should. Yeah, I don't think I can top it. I mean,
no, I don't think anyone can. I mean, that's the most existentially absurd and meaningless thing that can possibly happen. I think we got to retire the segment, man. I think it's over.
You're right. I think starting next week, because I have thought about this, that we've hit a peak on this thing and it's time to move on. I think next week we have to have questions. That's what it should be. The last thing should be one question for each other.
Great. My first question is going to be, has anyone out there ever stepped on a rake and had it come up and bark them in the head?
I actually meant for each other, but that's fine. An open-ended question. If you want to tell us about your rake stories, please feel free to tweet us.
I don't know. Okay. I don't know what we're going to do, but I'm unilaterally declaring this the end of this segment. There's no more one last meaningless thing to end this meaningless thing because you have achieved the impossible. You have like
pure meaningless.
Yes. Pure cosmic meaninglessness. In like the most interesting possible way. Congratulations. There's no more. This segment's over forever.
That's it. It's done. That's it.
It's fitting because it's the end of baseball season, right? It's the it's the end of this is like the time of fall heading into winter. It's November. Trees are gonna die soon. Like the earth will be reborn. Baseball season will be reborn, and when it does, there will be a new segment at the end of this stupid podcast that we do. All right, it's over. That's it. No more meaningless things. It's over.
That's it. We're done. We are done. All right, Michael. Well, as always, thank you.
And thanks for having me.